Hi, I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games, and on today's episode of the AIAS Game Makers Notebook, I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Genova Chen, who is the creative director at that game company. Genova's background as both a computer scientist and an artist gives him a unique perspective on designing games. And during our conversation, Genova explains how the intersection of art and human nature creates unconventional and unique experiences in games like Flower, Journey, and Sky. Please join me as Genova gives the kind of insight that I think no one else can in this industry.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Thank you for joining.
Thank you, Ted, and this is a lovely place to be here.
Thanks. Well, yeah. Just to fill in for our listeners, we are at Insomniac. We're in our sort of our podcast/live streaming room. Mm-hmm. And Genova, you've never been over here. So even though we live in the same city, we never had a chance to go to each other's various locations.
It's almost an hour of drive. You know, an hour I can fly to San Jose.
That's the crazy thing about Los Angeles, right? It just takes so long. Mm-hmm. And to ask you a crazy question that has nothing to do with games, when automated cars come out, are you going to get one?
I've already got one.
Oh, you do?
Yes. I have a Tesla Model 3, and it's capable of full autopilot when it's legal.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's great to hear, because personally, I can't wait till I have an automated car and I don't have to worry about staying awake.
I'm going to say, when I first used the autopilot feature, it's kind of scary.
Really?
And it just kind of gave me heart attacks sometimes. I'm like, is this going to hit a car? But after you use it for a while, you kind of just like, you turn that part of driving off. And from that point on, it's just using your cell phone.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I definitely look for the future. Recently, I thought Elon Musk was asking for video game developers to develop games in their cars. I'm just like, really? But that future is coming faster than I thought. You know, last year, I just thought, there's no way this thing can drive on free roads. And, you know, then they announced they have something in the work and they showed a video of the car doing that. And, you know, they announced they think they're going to get full autonomous last year. But, you know, now it's 2018. I think it's going to come soon. And a lot of my friends, including my parents, who don't know how to drive cars, and I'm like, okay, well, you should never, and in the future, all the cars is going to drive themselves.
Well, that's a great point. I have a bunch of kids, and my oldest kids are excited about driving cars, but my youngest two have very little interest in it, and that's because I think they know that they're not going to have to worry about it.
Yeah, I heard that the American youth are like losing their interest in getting driver's license.
I would think that would put the car manufacturers in a state of maybe semi-panic. Because, I mean, unless they're on board and creating automated cars, this lust for muscle cars and the next greatest thing that you can drive,
you know, that's very interesting, because I'm very sure the youth would prefer to use their smartphone in a car rather than driving the car.
Yeah.
And what is the new culture for muscle? You know, like muscle car, it's the thing to show, you know, the manhood, right? Like, is it going to be just about your pro gamer seats for the future when you stream your game? Like, how do you even show that? I guess car was a big thing that represents you when you arrive.
Right.
But I think the future is more about what represents you when you're arriving to social media.
Yeah, there you go.
You know?
So I think for us as game makers too, it's exciting to think that people will be playing games in the cars, right? You'll have your Switch or your iPhone or maybe even some other form of a PlayStation or Xbox or PC in your car, and you can play, for example, Sky when you're on the road. And I think that's, for me as a game player, pretty exciting too.
Yeah. Lately, you know, as I was developing mobile games, I tried to play as much mobile games as I could. And I'm trying to get my wife into it. She's not really a gamer, but like my ambition has always been trying to make people in my, you know, social circle to care about game and to be able to get a good taste of what a good game is and, you know, ultimately respect developers. And so I would drag my wife into playing these games. And I noticed that, you know, playing on the go or playing a mobile game is completely different than playing a console game. Mm. It's, you know, I think the best analogy is like console game is like you pay your tickets, you go to a really good theater with a really large screen and good sound speakers, you know, with people you really want to share this, you know, kind of intense experience with. Mobile game is more like, you know, just checking your smartphone and, you know, everything is trying to compete for your attention, right? Like in the middle of a game, you'll get a call, you got a text message, you got a Snapchat. Everything could potentially just grab your attention away. And then we're like, what was I into? Oh yeah, I was thinking about checking Facebook, trying to talk to somebody, but then the Facebook feed just dragged my attention for another 10 minutes. I was like, what am I watching? Wait, why was I here in the first place? Oh yeah, I need to talk to somebody. Yeah, it's a brutal attention battleground. And yeah. I remember going to a Netflix presentation where Reed Hastings was talking about their strategy is to compete not just with, you know, streaming, but with video games, with everything, because, you know, ultimately we only have 24/7, right? And modern day with the device and the internet, you can reach them anywhere, anytime. And so ultimately, how much time do you want your audience to give you, you know, that you think is valuable? I think this is ultimately the question for people who wants to create value, mm-hmm. right? You know, there are people who just want to grab your attention regardless what they do. But I think I've sidetracked the topic.
Well, that's okay. Well, you brought up something that I'm really interested in. You mm-hmm. said that you try to get your wife to play more mobile games. Mm-hmm. And I think by extension, you've been encouraging others who maybe don't play games to, mm-hmm. to play games.
Yeah.
What are some of the mobile games that you have suggested to mm-hmm. bring them into our world?
Well, I think it's more like me and my wife. Well, she doesn't know me. When we first get to know each other, I certainly ask her to play my games so she get a sense who I am. I think it's very interesting that how her view on game developers is completely different. Mm. So when I first met her, that's after I finished Journey, and when we talk, I had a lot of ego there, right? You know, after we won the Game of the Year, I felt like, oh, I'm somebody. I did something great. But she doesn't care, right? And, you know, one of her friends is a mobile developer. I think they called FunPlus, which is kind of like a casual social game on Facebook, but they're like number two Zynga, so they're very successful. So when I first met her, she just asked me, how much money do you make? I'm like, no, we don't make money by making art games, you know? But then at the same time, I have this sense of, you know, we make great things. I don't think your casual game friends would really make that things, right? I mean, but she couldn't tell the difference. Like her favorite game is Plants vs. Zombies. I can understand, it's cute, and she played a lot. And so then I asked her to play Flower, and she actually really enjoyed the game.
Okay.
And I asked her to play Journey. I thought Journey was made really simple. There's only two buttons. You know, we thought we made it to be easy enough for anyone to play, but she couldn't finish Journey.
Wow.
And so she had to find a friend of her, and she also played video games. So she finished the game for her, and she has to watch the game. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of like her really exposure to console games. She owns a PlayStation for almost 5 years. She never used it to play a game. She just used it to play Blu-ray discs. And I think only after she played the game and then, you know, I show her the words and other things, she starts to understand, oh, okay, video game can be like artistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, the industry changes so much in the past 10 years. I don't even know how to begin. I mean, I guess I'm getting old and getting cynical and a lot of people, because my wife works in the finance industry, they do a lot of merger acquisition or IPO, and a lot of these companies are game companies. And you know, like she knows people from like Angry Bird Rovio, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and Supercell, and you know, like there's a wide range of game studios. It's, yeah. I think it's a tough time for me to explain to her like who's good, who's not.
Yeah.
You know, I have a very different view. I think I'm more aligned with the academy, right? Like I think people make really great emotional experience, you know, that leaves impression on people is the best game.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about mm-hmm. that, because you and that game company have made a very clear choice to mm-hmm. create unconventional games. Games that mm-hmm. to what you said before are more about the message and not necessarily big commercial plays. Mm-hmm. So have you ever had a situation where somebody has told you, hey, Genova, that idea, it's just never going to sell. You're not going to make any money. Why are you doing this?
I think just 2 days ago, someone was telling me this.
Really?
And they told me Sky is never going to be a big game, big successful game.
I hope it wasn't somebody on your team.
No. It's someone from, respectful publisher. And actually, I really respect their opinions. Because, you know, after all, you work on some game for a very long time, you lose that sense of how this is. I mean, when we work on Journey, we never thought it's going to be a Game of the Year game.
Right.
We just thought, well, you know, finally we got about to finish it. You know, it's so much tough work, and I hope people like it. but yeah, I mean.
So how do you respond to that? Because mm-hmm. your games are so unique, and I think they create this really neat sense of excitement for those mm-hmm. of us who are hardcore gamers and see something, mm-hmm. see you taking creative risks and putting your team's emotions out there on display through mm-hmm. the games that you make. How do you respond to somebody who is taking that sort of hard-nosed financial approach?
Yeah, I think you summarize it well. It is like my professional job is to take creative risk. Mm-hmm. And for someone from a big publisher company who think about, you know, the P&Ls, the earnings, they do see us as risky. I mean, I was talking to Tencent, you know, quite a few times about potentially publishing Sky. And their feedback was, usually we like to embrace in a risky project where it's risky on one aspect, but the other thing is safe. Like, you know, if it's a risky concept, but the business model is safe, then, you know, we're happy to take it. But you have risky concept, risky business model, you know, and unproven market. There's too many risks that I feel like we are not really interested. Unless you prove you are already successful, then we're interested in publishing.
Right? I mean, it's, well, that's the conundrum today, isn't it? When it comes to publishing. But on mm-hmm. the other hand, you're working on a mobile platform that has the largest install player base mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. and you're also embracing multiplayer, which mm-hmm. is also extremely exciting, and it makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. for that platform. And what I've heard you say already publicly about Sky is that you built it from the ground up to support the swipe mechanic that mm-hmm. you see on mobile versus trying to take an idea that was maybe originally made for console mm-hmm. and bringing it over. So those, to me, are all really positive statements about the potential for the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we are taking all these steps. The irony is nothing is absolute. When we spend all these years trying to explore how to make a input scheme simple and intuitive for the touchscreen. The public are all caught up. If you play, PlayerUnknown Battleground, right, and or the Fortnite, you would realize, hey, that's basically a twin stick controller mapped onto the screen,
right?
Which people hated when we first started developing the game back in 2014, right? People were like, this virtual sticks thing sucks. The stick is better. Everybody's saying that, right? So I feel the same way. And that's why we're diving so much into finding what is good for the touchscreen by itself. But, you know, 6 years later, the feedback is different. Because so many people were brought up with these virtual sticks, you know, oh, think about all the kids who play Minecraft.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, where's the virtual stick? You know, what is this new control scheme I have to learn? Just give me the twin sticks. It's already working.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And I hear this from, you know, China. I hear this from, you know, various type of people. You know, like mostly those people who don't play console games would ask for virtual stick. The people who play console games would say, just give me the controller.
Right.
And yeah, it's kind of like, I think the biggest difference I have been facing today compared to, you know, 10 years ago when we were working on PlayStation is just the amount of information. You know, today we're living in this big data age. We know exactly where people are quitting the game, having difficulty with the game, or complain about a control scheme. What are they complaining about? You know, like back then when we were on console, we have to like bring 5-10 people, let them play the game, and we have to do this focus group, trying to be neutral and get really useful feedback from these people. But today you can just send a build out to, you know, anybody who's playing at home. You know, they don't have to care about how you think about them. They just talk to the microphone, and you get all kinds of people who you would have never thought about playing your game. And for me, the most crazy one is some guy who's driving a car is test playing our game. I can hear like people honking at him.
Really?
Yeah.
So I was. He's not driving an automated car. He's driving a real car.
And I can tell he's in the car and he's playing this game, and I'm just like, he's gonna kill somebody, or he's trying to make some extra money while he's probably in a trucker or something. And you get all these data, and I almost felt like, you know, I might have been swayed by the data too much, kind of post-mortem, right?
Did that data help you understand who your players really are? The people who gravitate to Journey, to Sky, to Flower?
Yeah, this is like the first question whenever I talk to someone who don't know about us. They were just like, what are your, you know, market? Who are you making this game for? Right? And I think that's like the artist side of me have a very idealistic view of the world. And, you know, I often tell them, I said, you know, like growing up, people go to watch film together as a family. They go to theme park together as a family. And why can't people just play a game together as a family, right? I mean, just makes sense. And everybody grew up now have played a video game. Everybody's video game literate.
Yeah.
But where is a video game that is the equivalent of a Pixar movie or the Disneyland where everybody can have fun together, but, you know, the adults can still be emotionally engaged? I'm not talking about, Minecraft or, you know, Lego Star Wars or something. I'm talking about something that inspired adults, you know, just like a Pixar movie or any Disney movie, really. You know, something that adults and children or husband and wife can do together. And that's just a very, I think that's just like, duh, obviously there's a market there, you know, someone's going to make something, right? And so it's a no-brainer for me to pursuing for that direction, because, you know, my ultimate goal is to earn respect from the society towards games. And how could you earn respect? you have to entertain them, the people who play games, their family, their children, and give them something that they really feel is speaking to them.
Yeah. I think that's special. I mean, I know personally, and this is totally anecdotal, that it has, your games have provided that experience for me. I played all the way through Flower and Journey with my oldest daughter. And in both situations, those were bonding moments. And we were taking turns with the controller, but we were experiencing it as a family. And because there was no real heavy conflict, and we got to interpret the story as we saw fit, it it sparked conversation about what you and your team intended. We talked about that, especially with Flower, because we really had to sort of build our own little story around what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I want. Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like what the story you told me is actually what I was hoping that, you know, Sky could inspire people to do. Yeah, because not everybody's going to have the time or the setup where they can have, you know, like all the people in the same room and going through it together. But at the same time, it's kind of hard because when we look at the market, if you search for family playing games together, right? And you might find some images of people playing Wii.
Yeah.
But in my home country, China, where it's right now the largest mobile game market, you search for family playing games together, you couldn't find a single image of a family sitting together playing games. That just doesn't exist. It's kind of like...
Is that a cultural thing, or is it just that there really aren't any games?
Because there was never a console in China.
Okay.
Right? So the only access to game is PC and mobile. And yeah, I mean, it's... So a lot of people was challenging me on like, well, if... It's kind of a chicken egg question. If nobody knows you're supposed to play games with your family, how are you supposed to, you know, make money out of it, right? There's a lot of questions that I don't think I can answer in a rational way. But yeah,
well, that question you just stated: how can you make money if you're making games for families? To me, there's an obvious answer. If you have a family and you want to connect with them, then those games are like gold because today, in today's world where our kids are playing video games and we're playing video games, there really aren't many better ways to have fun together other than if you happen to be able to play sports together or maybe you're going camping together, but not everybody has access to those events. Video games, for the most part, are accessible to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And, in a way, what happened is some of these mobile games become so universally adopted that usually I run to these teenage girls who play, you know, a Fortnite or, the mobile version of League of Legends. I was like, why are you playing this game? You don't seem like the demographic for this type of game. She's just like, well, because all my friends in the class are playing, and I just feel like if I don't play, I couldn't blend into the culture anymore. I have to play it. And that was just kind of mind-boggling for me. It's just like, it's not a game designed for them that actually did it, but it's like this other game that is so popular, and all these people converted into a game player.
So with Sky, you're taking that, you're in some ways filling a niche that's being, in a way, filled by other games that weren't designed for it. And I, watching the trailers that you've put out and the gameplay that you put out so far, what's intrigued me really is this idea that you can uncover mysteries and discover a story together as a family. And so when it comes to you and the team deciding on what you're going to do, how important is presenting mysteries and presenting a story that isn't explicitly told? That's my impression from watching Sky and also from playing Flower and Journey.
We internally call it interactive storytelling. We call it story digging.
Okay. That's a great term.
So Because ultimately, the player has to piece together information and put a storyline themselves, and that's what human does. You know, if you put me in the desert and there's nothing, but in the distance there's a little roof. I mean, 100%, I'm going to there. I'm not going anywhere else because I'm a sucker to human civilization and stories. And I just find, you know, like naturally we put story together. If we're sitting in a train, we see somebody, that person looks sad. We are already thinking about what happened to him. You know, what's his relationship with the lady next to him? What happened? Did they have a fight? You know, it's just our empathy, really, or curiosity, and all these kind of what I consider as good nature of humanity. And yeah, like when we were taught in the film school, what we say is show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. It's when I was in advertisement class, people would say, don't ever repeat the same message with two different elements. You know, if you put an apple on the advertisement, don't say apple below an apple image. Like that's just waste of effort. And I felt like for video game, it's the same. It's like, if you want to communicate something, you let the player to figure it out. You know, it's through interactivity, right? You know, if you have a visual medium, use the visuals. Don't just say it and, you know, let them use the strongest form of media to explore a story. And so there are various ways of interactive storytelling. There's the, you know, Telltale, there's Quantic Dream. For our philosophy, it's more like we want to give the player the choice and the control to, you know, consume or to engage, to understand the narrative of the world. And Journey and Flower is more of a narrative of yourself, like what you go through. Mm-hmm. Journey is two things. It's like what you go through and then what do you think had happened here. And it's we almost have the two storyline, and a lot of times we get confused. Like, what are we trying to make this for? Are we just trying to tell the history of this world, or are we trying to make the player's narrative interesting? You know, with Sky, it's the same thing. We're burying all these story bits, hoping after you dig them out that you can piece them together and come to something that's interesting. But at the same time, the challenging part is often when you're busy burying stuff, you forgot about how the player's experience is going to be as they play through the game. A lot of people were saying, like, video game is not like a movie. You can't write a story in a linear format because people have agency, right? But for me, ultimately, human beings are linear. Time is linear. And no matter how you play an open world game, if you sequence everything you experience, it's still a linear experience. As long as that memory is linear, you should be able to craft emotional arc in a memory. So ultimately, it's like, how can we shape your memory to create feeling? With console, it was relatively simple. You can have people sit down, stare at the TV for 90 minutes to 2 hours. You can guarantee what they're going to experience. With mobile now, yeah, there's a it's going to be sporadic, right? Like, it's just that nature. And yeah, I was playing Sky last night and some people dragged me on to play the game, but then my wife gave me food I have to eat and I can't leave that game. So I'm like just putting down the phone, just holding on the hands of someone. They are playing the game. I'm just eating. And then my wife started talking to me and I missed out what's going on there. It's just, it's a bunch of new challenges. I think that's kind of the fun part of this project is just, it's hard.
Well, so when you see people experiencing the game in certain ways, does that influence big design decisions that you're making as you finish the game up?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of things have you, for example, been surprised by as you've been seeing people play early versions of the game?
I think, you know, initially we, the developer, were the consumers first. We played the game and we would pretend these sessions, and afterwards we'll say that, yeah, I really hated that thing that happened to me. And then we start to see beta testers to play the game, and then they start to kind of develop these behavior that I've never thought about. And okay. I think with online game, it's always, you feel like a parent of a little community, and there are certain behavior you don't allow in this family, right? And sometimes you don't know that's something you really don't allow until it happens. So when we, just an example, when we were doing very early version, we had a kind of friends and family test. Sky is a game about giving, and a lot of the economy happens in giving rather than buying, right? And so we made a very simple system where, let's say if you really want something, you need someone to give it to you, right? And so some player would ask their dad to get an account so their dad can just keep giving him gifts, right? Like just unlimited giving. And I was just like, oh, that's just really break the balance of the game. You know, if you have a rich dad who can just buy you all these things, nobody likes to see that happen in the community. So we have to figure out a way to prevent someone just having a rich uncle or something to like spoil the situation. And then we have the opposite. Initially, our knee-jerk reaction is, oh, you can only give one, right? Like it only matters once. It's like voting in America. You can't, just because you're rich, you can't vote multiple times. You can only vote once. But then what happened is you got people who's really popular. I mean, they like to dress up really cute and do all these fancy moves to beg for votes. And we start to call them the candle baggers. They just go around to talk to everybody, trying to be as polite as they could until they get their vote, and then they move on to the next person. Like the moment you get your vote, they disappear, right?
What an interesting commentary on person, on just people, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably, do you see that behavior? I mean, I imagine you know people who have that behavior in real life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, I mean, I started to experience that from Journey. I mean, Journey, we want to have people help each other. Mm-hmm. And that's a very tough challenge itself, because most of the time people don't like each other when there's a conflict of interest. And what I learned from Journey was that it's not about like punishing people for what you don't want them to do. It's about giving them the least amount of feedback for things that you don't want them to do. I talked to a child psychologist who mentioned about, you know, gamer and virtual worlds. When you go from reality to a virtual world, you become a child. Because in the virtual world, the rules, the traditions, the moral values don't apply in virtual world. That's why there's so many trolls on the internet. They're just testing the boundaries. Like a baby likes to test the boundaries, right? I just had a baby recently, so I'm sure you have your experience as well. And so in a virtual society, when everybody's like testing the boundaries, because we are human beings, we're curious animals, how do you make people behave more towards a certain direction that you believe in, and how to prevent? It's all about controlling the amount of feedback. And through Journey, like this kind of painful process, what I learned is you can make people do anything if you structure the world and the society right, you know? And so coming back to the candle bagger situation, or the spoil your kids situation, we start to, you know, try to play various feedback to prevent certain behaviors. It's almost like lawmaking,
but in, right? A very subtle way.
Yeah, very subtle way. You can't make it like, we told you have to do this. Like, we have to make you feel like you're smart. You figure out doing this is better, right?
Yeah.
So we talk about how the best practice of design is a nudge, where you know, it's not about leash, it's about nudging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great philosophy. We debate at Insomniac all the time how much handholding we want to do for players, because at some point players need to know the rules if they're going to proceed. Mm-hmm. But there's easily a line you can cross when you're being prescriptive. And then that sense of discovery is gone.
I would say we are making that mistake every day. It's a very delicate balance.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's great that you're getting consistent and constant feedback from players who are, I presume, not part of that game company online and showing you new behaviors all the time. Do you expect that after launch you'll be seeing even more unusual and unexpected behaviors and then making tweaks to
address it? the interesting thing about mobile games are these days is you can do soft launch.
Yeah.
So right now our game is in a handful of countries, Sweden, Philippines, New Zealand, and Singapore. So they're a real player. They are using a real store. They see our game as already launched. Yeah. Obviously, it's not as polished as we would expect, but they are definitely behaving like a real player, how they would do. I think it's very different. You know, when I was working on PlayStation, we brought in about 25 players to play Journey when it's almost finished, right? Five people at a round. And we thought that feedback was like really good. But so when we entered the mobile era, we started to do a playtest the same way. We'll bring these mobile players into our studio. We have them sit down on a couch, give them a device, let them play. But what we get from this group of people, and later compared to like what you get just by people recording and playing at home, the quality is completely different. I think there's always this feeling of, oh, I come to someone's house or their office. I'm here to getting paid to play their game, so I have to say something nice, right? Otherwise, I feel uncomfortable. Right, and the people who play in their bedroom on their pajamas, they're brutal.
Yeah. Well, do you see, so if you've soft launched in several countries, are you talking about tens of thousands of players right now who are checking it out?
Yeah.
How do you sift that data? How do you make it? And this is sort of this is more of a business-like question. How do you take those comments and aggregate them and translate them in a way that is useful for the team?
Yeah, it's a hard thing. I have to say it's kind of like the data is dangerous, and you don't want everybody to prematurely reacting to data. Mm-hmm. I've made a few mistakes like that, and ultimately, data to me is almost like how a doctor reads symptoms. I have a real example. My mom went through a lot of surgeries. She has glaucoma, and when I took her to UCLA, and the first person coming to see my mom is the interns, the students who's still learning, right? They were just there to take the measurements.
Yeah.
And as they measure, they would be like, oh, your mom's eye pressure is too high. You need surgery right away, right? And I got super anxious, right? Like, oh, geez, really? Shit. And then the next person coming is like the more experienced kind of staff doctor. And then they will look at my mom and I'll be like, oh, the previous guy says my mom needs surgery right away. What do you think? And then this person will be like, oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, this number is pretty high, you know, and if I were, the doctor, I'm going to say she needs surgery right away. And then I'm just like, oh, crazy. I mean, this is going to be bad. And finally, the doctor came in who was like really experienced. He's just like, I told him the previous two doctors told me my mom's pressure is too high. We need to get surgery right away. His first reaction is, there's no way her eye pressure is going to be this number. Hmm. Let's retake the test. Right?
Yeah.
And the test is much lower. I was like, but how is the test so high? Well, because when that guy measured your mom's eye pressure, he applied his finger onto her eyeball, so he got higher pressures. It happens to a lot of these people with smaller eyes, you know, because these interns, they don't pay attention. So never trust their measurements, right? Like, if that doctor just said, oh yeah, the pressure is high, my mom would went to surgery that day.
Right.
But he had the experience. He know people make these mistakes. He knows how to read a wrong situation like that. And same thing, then my mom had surgery, and when she went back to China, she's feeling some uncomfortableness. She went to the Chinese doctor, and they were like, my mom's eye get red, right? So they were like, well, it must be that the surgery she took in America is failing. We can't fix this, you know? You gotta go to talk to the doctor in America. And then once my mom come back to America, she see the doctor, we thought it's gonna be a serious issue. The doctor says, oh, it looks like she's allergic to the eye drops. Let's change the eye drop. Gone, right? It's just like, I think.
So the experience allows you to sift through the data and pick out what's right. meaningful, more quickly?
It's the same thing. It's like I started not as a very experienced doctor, and all this data comes in. I'm just like, oh, okay, well, these are interesting. You know, like people are leaving a lot here. Why are they leaving, right? And the data just says they're leaving a lot in this particular part of the game. But everybody have different opinions.
Yeah.
Someone says, oh, maybe they haven't fly yet, so they didn't even see the exciting scene. Obviously, they left. Or maybe they haven't made friends in the game, right? Or maybe the control sucks. Or maybe the performance is too low, so it's very hot on your phone. That's also why they quit, right? Like it's just so many different ways you can read the data. And, you know, when we first react to the data without further evaluation, we end up changing the game a little bit, but then that doesn't really solve the problem, right? Like sometimes you can put a couple duct tapes on the top, but that doesn't change the root problem.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, it is really just like a doctor, right? You have a game and the data just tells you there's something wrong about it, but you know, is that a stomach ache? Is that a bad bug? It's all kinds of possibility.
Yeah.
I guess I've made a lot of mistakes to felt like, you know, at least now I will always have a very suspicious and reserved view on any new data, because overreacting is always bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of geeked out on this.
I love
what,
it.
What
I
are mean, we talking about?
That's a great analogy. Yeah. It's something I think is useful for all designers. If you can think like a doctor, an experienced doctor, and evaluate each set of data based on your experience versus your gut versus your sort of knee-jerk reaction,
right,
then the changes you'll make will be more measured.
Yeah.
So speaking of making changes, when you're discussing making changes to the game with the team, how does that process work? Do you have a collaborative, consensus-driven decision-making process, or is it something else?
I would say that our process is probably not the best process.
By the way, my question was totally leading, so I apologize for that. what works for you guys when you have to make one of those difficult decisions about a core component of the game?
So Sky is not out. You know, I wouldn't use Sky as example because I don't know if the decision we made was the right decision. With Journey, it's easier to look back and see, okay, you know, there are definitely, I would think there's three kinds of decision making. There's democracy, where everybody vote and, you know, the majority wins. And that tends to generate the worst outcome. I don't know why, but it happened to be the case, just looking back. There's unanimous agreement on a decision, and that's usually good. And then there's these kind of power decision-making where the leads decide to do it a certain way, and even though the others don't agree. Personally, I believe in the last one when that lead is passionate about it.
Okay.
You know, when they are so passionate about it, even though in confronting with all kinds of rational reason why they shouldn't do it. They still want to do it. They end up doing it in their own time over the weekend. That's usually when things work.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but this ended up being very tough because, you know, like supporting someone who believes in something, the people who didn't believe in it will get hurt. Yeah, and journey was a very painful process. You know, a lot of people have a lot of passion. They believe in things, and we don't have the money or the time to allow them to do it. And, you know, so I would think that those decisions that's driven by passion are more likely to succeed. It's not about being right. It's about just whether the person wants to put themselves into it to make it work.
Yep. I agree. I mean, I think your passion can make things right because when we are faced with a difficult creative decision in games, there isn't any right or wrong, right? We just don't know. Nobody has, in many cases, nobody's done that thing before.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at your games and what you do with your games, and you're doing things that nobody's done and making suppositions that are, you know, creatively risky, but who can tell what's going to work? So if you have passion, it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that it can work.
Yeah. I mean, this happens, you know, with myself, you know, I think when I was doing it, it's definitely a double-edged sword because if I believe in something and other people don't, and I end up doing all this extra work to make it work, it disencourages other people.
True.
Right. And, you know, back then when we were a smaller studio, there's only this field of guys, you know, I can do that all the time. But as the team gets bigger, you know, every time I do a power play like that, people, you know, disengage. And I start to see the attrition of that. And as the team get bigger, the better way, looking back, is to make those people feel passionate about something, you know, and when they really believe it and let them do it. And I think I still have to learn that myself. You know, sometimes I'm just very rational. I'm like, I don't think this is going to work. There's reason 1, 2, 3, you know, all these reasons. And yeah, ultimately I trust the passion of the people.
I'm sure there are times where you have to decide, make some pretty big decisions. And so how do you pick your particular battles that you want to engage in?
I think we get lost all the time. And one thing that I feel is very important is to, I think Steve Jobs mentioned about his cancer and how his cancer made him be able to prioritize a lot more efficiently. And I had a similar experience when I was working on Journey, where I thought I have brain cancer. And so for 3 months, I don't know the answer of it, right? I just assume something's wrong, you know, that could be terminal.
Wow.
And that allowed me to think through everything in life. You know, should I quit my job now? Should I go to see my parents? Should I get married? Should I have a kid? Should I go around the world? Should I do this and that? And ultimately, after I go through all the options, I realized that finishing the game is probably the most important thing I can do, or the most valuable thing I can leave to this society. And then it's just about making the game better and thinking I'm probably going to die before the game ships. What's most important is to create a clear direction. So even if I die, the direction can be passed along, right? And that helped me to prioritize. On the contrary, with Sky, it's actually less intense because I'm not thinking I'm going to die, right? And a lot of the kind of time we spend exploring in a retrospective, I felt because we had more money, we were able to afford to let people try and make mistakes. But if in a much tighter environment with less money or tighter budget, we probably would have used the gut instinct calls, right? Rather than being a civil way, okay, let's try that. You know, that doesn't work. Let's try the other one, right? Like, yeah, I mean, it's inevitably a difficult process for creatives because I think we need that pressure to afford letting these people making guts calls. But if these people are making guts calls, they tend to stomp onto other people and make other people feel unhappy. And so I don't know what's the optimal solution here,
Ted. Well, it's a great discussion. I don't think there is an answer. It's like most creative decisions in games. You have to sort of feel it out mm-hmm. and understand the dynamics of your team, right? Mm-hmm. So speaking of team, how would you describe the culture at that game company, given that you guys have produced games that are so unique? What's magic to you about the culture?
We used to be neighbor to Riot Games.
Okay.
So during lunchtime, we often see Riot Games people, at restaurant. And so it's very clear, like, that's a Riot guy, and we are not. and I think the culture is defined by the leadership, by the people who you know, are leading in the company. Mm-hmm. Just because when we founded TGC, it's a bunch of us who are students who are indies. I mean, we can't afford to recruit anyone. Nobody would join us. We're just a bunch of kids. So it's this, you know, always question everything, you know, just because it works in other places doesn't necessarily mean it will work here. This kind of very, academic or somewhat cynical view on everything is kind of happening in TGC. So we have a lot of people who are smart and probably think way too much on everything. Yeah.
Wouldn't you say that applies to the game industry in general? I mean, we have so many smart people in the game industry. Uh-huh. And
yeah.
I think in many ways we've been trained to question everything mm-hmm. because we've been playing games since most of us have been playing games since we were able to walk mm-hmm. and games challenge our expectations, our views of reality. I see that in Insomniac all the time. People mm-hmm. are always challenging a decision or a direction that we're heading because that's the way we're built in, at least in this industry, which in some ways allows us to evolve very much more quickly, perhaps, than some of the more traditional industries.
Yeah, I think what defines TGC is that we believe we are making something fresh, something mm-hmm. people haven't seen. I mean, it's a ship, it's a pirate ship that explores the new areas.
A pirate ship, I love it. Okay.
Yeah. So people feel we're doing cool stuff, but at the same time, you know, pirate ships or any ships, right? There will be this situation where we've been wandering in the open ocean for a long time. Does the captain still know where he's going, or is he crazy, right? And that happens also on pirate ship, you know, like, I think our culture is we believe in, you know, exploration.
Yeah.
If something doesn't work, we will try something else. I think we have more tolerance on that, on making mistakes, than in a AAA situation where, you know, it's so expensive that you can't afford like five mistakes in a row.
Right.
You will be like running out of money right away. Well, for us, we gave it a lot of time. I think Flower was like the first 75% of development is exploration and 25% finishing the game.
Yeah.
And Journey, it was 2 years exploring and 1 year finishing. And Sky is kind of crazy now. We've been exploring for the first 3 years for a premium game and then the second 3 years for a freemium game. And we're just about to like enter the finishing, you know, and it's like hundreds of levels has been made And in the end, we're only going to keep, you know, maybe 10.
Yeah.
It's just the same level has been remade so many different times that I think, you know, a lot of people who, you know, joined TGC a long time ago and left TGC sometime in the middle, the biggest torn is just that they don't feel they're making progress, right? We're trying this direction, we're trying that direction, we're trying that direction. Are we making circles? Or are we going to find the new land, the new continent, right?
I can commiserate because making new IP is hard. Mm-hmm. It really is. And those companies that perhaps don't spend time generating new intellectual property, it's hard to understand that you are going to make a lot of mistakes. You're going to move in different directions and false directions and have to rework much of what you thought was going to be in mm-hmm. the final game. And that's hard. And it takes a certain type of person who is flexible and persistent and patient to get to the finish line on new IP.
Yeah, and those people, I can guarantee you, they don't know if it's going to work until it's right. in the market.
That's right.
It's a lot of uncertainty, and uncertainty is kind of the worst. You know, if yeah. you know you're going to die tomorrow, it's actually easy.
But I'm laughing, but that's, yes, that's, I imagine it makes those, as you pointed out before, uh-huh. your decisions much clearer.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a forcing factor. Well, one thing, though, that struck me about something you said recently was when you talked about Sky, you mm-hmm. said compassion, generosity, and collaboration is mm-hmm. the focus. And to me, as a player, that is a refreshing message. And I find it refreshing because given the world we see around us today, where those qualities seem to be diminishing sometimes, especially when you watch the news and you see our leaders talking, having a game that presents the alternative is heartening. So mm-hmm. you guys have been putting out messages, these, I think, positive messages with your games again and again. And do you feel like that's a message that you want the world to hear? And that's again, sort of a softball question, but I would love for you to talk about how you personally feel mm-hmm. and when it comes to your games and what they're saying to everybody.
I think every art form, you know, when an artist creates, it's always created with a desire of trying to be understood, trying to be heard, trying to be connected. So Megan Allison is the founder of Annapurna, and I just want to quote a story. She mentioned, you know, she sometimes felt alone growing up, imagine in her situation, that only through art she felt she is not alone. She's connected with these creators, these storytellers, that she felt she's no different from them. And it's that help she had from art made her, you know, passionate about supporting the artist. And when we create games, there are all these feelings about the world. And hopefully, I mean, everybody wants their work and their artwork to be popular, to be accepted, to be, you know, celebrated. But the only way to do that is to sense the society, right? Sense the feelings around, and the odds are you have some anxiety about something the other people do, right? Great art always emerges at dramatic, tragic times because more people are able to relate towards something that is strong. But, you know, ultimately, each artist has their own voice. They grew up in their own environment, and they represent a particular group of people's voice. We can only hope for that we happen to have a voice that a lot of people adore. And for the artist to stay sane is they have to believe in themselves. They have to believe in their own feelings. And to really capture their own rather than to chase for the trend, because that's no longer authentic. And so for, you know, Flower Journey and Sky, I follow my own instinct. I tend to tell people like I'm kind of like those old school romanticism oil painters. You know, they like to paint nature, but they make it more colorful than real to capture the feeling when they saw the real nature, how it feels. I mean, art is all about exaggeration and the selective editing, like by removing things, it enhances something else. I remember that first piece of art, you know, it's this clay figure of a lady with big boobs and butts, right? I mean, they call it art. Why is it art? Because real people don't have that proportion. But with that exaggerated proportion, you're like, oh God, she's kind of sexy. She can give birth to a lot of children, whatever back then people wanted to communicate. And so I remember reading these painters, oil painters, they wanted to capture the sunset, you know, because, you know, even with camera, if you take a photo of sunset, it looks nothing like the real sunset. Just how red it is, right? The camera only captures white because it's too bright. Mm-hmm. So in order to capture the brightness of the red, they have to put green paint around the red sun to make the red paint appear to be more strong than the rest of the painting, right? I mean, in real life, we never see green things around the sun. But ultimately, that's kind of who I am. I like to capture beauty. Beauty can be a beautiful sunset or desert or forest or flower fields, but beauty in interaction. What is that? You know, like you mentioned about, what I was going to say is, you know, like today's society, there's a lot of things going on, right? And why do I want to pick certain side of humanity, not the other side of the humanity? Humanity is gray. Reality is gray. And the reason people love sunset universally is because that's the only 15 minutes when the world is colorful, you know, it's tainted with color. And so humanity is gray. We do good things, we do bad things. It's all from the same people. Like I could be ugly if the condition is right. I could be beautiful if the condition is right. So what I was hoping to capture was by painting in the form of a video game is a beautiful moment between the people. And that's what I'm trying to capture. I mean, Journey is a beautiful moment between two. I hope I can capture something between more in Sky. And in order to capture these beauties, you have to exaggerate. You have to take out things that is, if you want to do something warm, you have to take out things that's cold. Or you have to actually have a cold thing there to force the warm to really stand out. One example in our development in Sky is we, you know, initially we have these people who will be like asking you for something, and once you give it to them, they just vanish, right? And it hurts me a lot because I felt like I was cheated. But at the same time, if you just make everybody's trade always safe, then it becomes kind of mundane. Like the fact someone could potentially take advantage of your vulnerability actually make other people who don't appear to be a more decent person. And I think that happens in World of Warcraft, you know, the whole Horde versus Alliance. The fact the Horde can kill you and they choose to not and collab with you is what people remembers. right? But if you just go to a PvE server, right, everybody can't kill everybody. You don't talk about those experiences.
Yeah.
To me, it's just like if all human interaction is a paint, you have to choose selectively. Some people like to do the very dark side of the things, like, you know, I know there's some Friday the 13th, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to kill all of you guys and you have to survive, but I'm going to kill you anyway. You know, it's one type of game, you know, like the spectrum is wide open. Anybody can pick any color of humanity to make them. There's the funny side, you know, there's the scary side, there's the, you know, action-packed, exciting side. And I think what I'm trying to paint is that the tender, the gentle, the warm side. It's just like my style. And I don't know why I don't want to make Call of Duties. I think too many people are making it, so it's not cool. But I deep down really love something beautiful.
Yeah.
So you can see the visual, the audio, they're all kind of like these romanticist style. And so making romantic gameplay to me is what differentiates, I guess, to other games. Yeah.
That is a fantastic statement. And I think many, many of your fans would agree with you 100% out there. Well, if people want to ask you follow-up questions or just get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Probably the best way is to reach me by my email. It's just genovacheng@gmail.com or genova@thatgamecompany.
Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter, but I haven't tweeted for years.
I have the same challenge. I'm on Twitter too, and I'm not very good at responding to people or really sharing much other than podcast news about the podcast. But that's great. Well, thank you for sharing that, and thanks everybody for listening, and thank you for sharing so much of yourself.
I'm really glad you're doing the podcast, because you know, like, people like me would never have reached out like this, and hopefully this is useful for whoever is out there listening.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.